From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Fairfax, California.
Glen Park.
Fillmore.
I'm from San Jose.
I'm from the Intermission.
UCCC World.
West Oakland.
East Oakland.
Coming up, a family seeks justice for the police shooting of a loved one.
¿Qué vas a hacer si te matan a un pariente?
He says, what would you do if they killed your family?
Then we hear how some gun owners are feeling up in arms about what may happen if Prop 63 passes.
You have to go through a full background check process just to be able to buy a box of 22 shells to go target shooting.
And we'll hear a remarkable story about how communication can help us heal.
It is said that time heals all wounds, but even if this saying is true, I'm sure it does not remove all of the scars.
Stories of justice and redemption on this special extended edition of Cross Currents. Fatal police shootings continue across the country. Yesterday in Charlotte, North Carolina, a police officer killed a black man named Keith Scott while serving a warrant for a different person. On Friday in Tulsa, Oklahoma, a black man named Terrence Crutcher was shot dead after his car broke down. A video shows he was unarmed with his hands in the air. San Francisco has been part of the national controversy around officer-involved shootings. Former police chief Greg Suhr resigned after police shot and killed Jessica Williams, who is also black, in Bayview Hunters Point. And last April, a Mexican immigrant named Luis Gongora was fatally shot by police in a homeless encampment in the Mission. The investigation into his death is still open. His family is left hurting and wants justice to be served. KALW's Lisa Cantrell has more.
So decimos justicia para Luis.
Yes.
Justicia. Digan nuestro nombre, digan su nombre, say his name. Luis Góngora Paz. Presente.
Presente.
It's a Sunday morning. In front of a makeshift altar, there are flowers and notes. A candle sits on the ground. A small crowd is gathered here in San Francisco's Mission District for the anniversary of the death of Luis Góngora. This is Jose Góngora, Luis Góngora's brother.
Cuando tenga tiempo vengo a ver. Estaba trabajando y saliendo del trabajo, yo vine para acá a ver como sé que siempre acá lo encuentro.
He says, I used to come here to see Luis every chance I had. Luis lived in a homeless encampment on this street, Shotwell near 18th. And Jose says it was here that he found out his brother had died. He says when he left work that day in April, he went to visit Luis like he always did. His brother had been homeless for a couple of years, but the two were close. When he got to Shotwell, he saw his brother's name painted on the sidewalk. He got a sick feeling in his stomach. He frantically tried to ask people if they had seen Luis.
Y dije, yo soy hermano de tal fulano.
I'm his brother, he told the people on the street. But they didn't understand his limited English. Jose, like his brother, immigrated to the U.S. from Mexico to look for jobs, make money. They grew up in an indigenous community speaking a Mayan language and some Spanish, but little English. Jose says he finally learned what happened to his brother from Laura Guzman, the woman who is leading the memorial today. She told him that Luis had been shot the day before by police.
Muchas gracias. Thank you. We meet every 7th. That's our meeting, and we usually...
Since Luis's death, a coalition of Luis's family, friends, and the community meets once a month. They come not only to remember Luis, but because they want justice for his death.
¿Qué vas a hacer si te matan a un pariente? A tu hermano, a tu hijo, a tu papá, a tu mamá, quien sea. Es una trauma. Y toda la familia está traumada. Inclusive hasta la comunidad.
That's Luis's cousin. His name is also Luis. Luis Put. He says, what would you do if they killed your family, your brother, your child, your father, your mother?
No es lo mismo un asesinato de las personas en la calle que pasan por incidentes.
He says, it's not the same as any murder in the streets. This was the police. They're supposed to take care of you, and they show up and kill you. He says, the family is destroyed. The family of Luis Góngora wants charges pressed against the officers who killed him. It may, however, be a losing battle. This is sound from a video from a surveillance camera near the spot where Luis died. A disclaimer, it's disturbing. It was about 10 in the morning. Police had gotten a call from the city's homeless outreach team saying there was a man in the area with a knife. Three officers pull up in squad cars. They walk towards Luis. Get on the ground, stay on the ground, they say. They then say, put that down. Shots begin. Police say Luis lunged with the knife, and that's why they opened fire. Eyewitnesses who spoke to news outlets disagree. They say police moved in on Luis quickly, in less than 30 seconds.
And so here you have officers who pull up on the scene and within moments get out and start confronting a person under threat of a shotgun, yelling at a person, barking commands at a person who they don't know whether or not this person understands what they're saying.
Adante Pointer is a civil rights lawyer who's representing Luis's family. Pointer works for the John Burris Law Firm, the same firm that brought civil charges against Bart in the Oscar Grant case. He's currently representing almost a dozen victims of officer-involved shootings in California, including Luis Góngora. He says holding officers accountable is hard. Unless someone is pushing, cases such as Grant's and Góngora's don't go to court.
Everything is geared towards protecting the officers, protecting the entity, despite the fact of how good your facts are or how egregious the circumstances are, and not about, in my opinion, getting to the bottom of why we're having these type of incidents take place and correcting them.
It's up to the DA, the Attorney General, or the U.S. Attorney to press criminal charges. However, it's tricky. The DA relies heavily on the police department to investigate and collect evidence in any homicide, including those where officers are involved.
There's an inherent conflict of interest.
According to an investigation by the San Francisco Chronicle, in the past 15 years, there have been 40 fatal officer-involved shootings in San Francisco. None of those officers were criminally charged. For the more recent deaths of Alex Nieto, Mario Woods, Amilcar Perez Lopez, coalitions have formed. The families say that had their loved ones died at the hands of anyone other than an officer, the DA would have already pressed charges. They feel that the system is failing them, turning a blind eye, protecting their own. Max Sabo is a spokesperson for the San Francisco District Attorney's Office.
People always ask, is there a different standard? Why are they held to a different standard?
He says that it's difficult to prosecute an officer. Legally, police are allowed to use lethal force when they perceive a threat. The DA can't do much about that. However, he says that the SFDA is on its way to addressing problematic conflicts of interest.
We want to make sure that these investigations are completely objective and independent, and in order to do that, we're taking appropriate steps to make sure that they are.
Sabo says that for homicide cases where the police are involved, the DA will no longer rely on the SFPD for evidence. It could mean that more officers are tried in court, but for Luis Góngora's family, any changes in the process are too late. And for them, it's frustrating. Luis's brother Jose is especially heartbroken. He says Luis was not just a brother, but a best friend.
Con él crecí, con él iba yo al campo. Y con él constantemente hasta ahora, hasta que me lo quitaron.
I grew up with him, Jose says. I was constantly with him until they took him away from me. The two grew up in Teabo, a small town in the Yucatan Peninsula where they swam in the reservoirs of their village. They rode horses and tended to the fields together near their home. Jose remembers how his brother loved animals and pranks. He says, we had a horse we would ride, but I didn't know how to ride it so well. For fun, Luis would sometimes try to make it throw me off, and he'd laugh. Sometimes in the evenings after we'd put the animals away, he'd hurry off and I'd be running behind him trying to catch up, but he always took care of me. The brothers did everything together. In 2001, Jose came to San Francisco. Luis followed him a year later in 2002. Jobs were hard to come by in Mexico and they had wives and children to support. Luis Góngora got a job working at Mel's Diner. His brother worked in another restaurant. Luis didn't speak much English or Spanish. He depended on others to translate to Yucatec Mayan. He did that for almost 10 years at Mel's. But then all the Mayan speakers left the restaurant, and Luis couldn't communicate. He lost his job. With no money to pay for rent, he and Jose were evicted from their apartment. They both ended up on the street. His cousin, Luis Pot, says that that's when things got bad.
Luis estaba más traumado que José, así que José está un poco más.
He says Luis Góngora was the more traumatized of the two. Meanwhile, José asked for help. The cousin says he only had room for one of the brothers, José. Still, Luis Góngora lived in a tent right in front of their apartment building. The circumstances were not ideal. Luis's mental state seemed to deteriorate. but he was still very much a part of the family.
Nosotros tenemos comunicación con Luis Góngora todos los...
They would communicate with Luis every week, talk to him, give him food, water, money. They'd lend him a phone so he could call Mexico. They were trying to help Luis get back to his wife and three children in Teabo. Now, however, they're trying to push for justice, for his death. Every other week, the brother and cousin go to a protest, march, or meeting. Tonight is a combined rally. Luis's supporters, as well as those of Alex Nieto, Mario Woods, and Amilcar Perez Lopez, other victims of fatal police confrontations. In the mission, cars stop at intersections to let protesters pass, 60 people strong. They're carrying signs and banners. A group dressed in indigenous Mayan garments lead the group with a drum. A decision for Amilcar's case is expected soon. Luis's case is still under investigation. The coalition say if District Attorney Gascon won't press charges, they'll ask California General Attorney Kamala Harris to step up. Jose, Luis Góngora's brother, is here at the march.
Acá un poco triste, pero estamos acá echándole ganas.
For months after his brother's death, Jose couldn't work. Today, he's sad, but doing his best. He marches, holding a picture of Luis, as he follows behind his cousin, who carries a large banner.
Que nunca lo voy a olvidar. En donde sea, siempre hasta ahora.
I'll never forget him, Jose says. No matter where I am, always. Because he's my big brother. For his part, Luis's cousin says that just like any other person, Luis Góngora deserves justice.
Luis Góngora es papá, es hermano, es primo, es un ser humano. Y quitarle la vida a una persona, cualquiera persona que lo cometa, debería llevarlo ante la justicia. Y eso es lo que estamos exigiendo.
He says Luis Góngora is a father, a brother, a cousin, a human being. Anyone who takes away the life of another person, it doesn't matter who they are, they should be given justice. That's what they'll keep fighting for. And if the criminal justice system fails them, they'll go to civil court. In San Francisco, I'm Lisa Cantrell for Cross Currents.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. California's November ballot reads like a Hell's Angels memoir. Weed, porn, death, and guns. More specifically, what goes in guns. Prop 63 spells out who would be able to buy ammunition and who's out of luck at the shooting range. Some Bay Area gun owners are taking aim at the initiative and telling supporters, hands off my ammo. KALW's Lucy Kang has the story.
Boxes of ammunition are stacked on the shelves of Coyote Point Armory in Burlingame, underneath rows of black rifles and other guns I can't name. Owner John Parkin has been in business here for 2 years. On a Friday afternoon, a steady stream of customers come in to look at handguns under the glass counters.
We're a basic gun store. We sell lots of ammo. We sell long rifles, shotguns, handguns, revolvers, everything in between.
Hanging from the walls of the store are lots and lots of guns, including one of the country's most contentious models.
So what I'm holding here is a Wilson Combat California legal AR-15.
Can I hold this?
Sure.
And this goes over the shoulder like this?
Don't point it at anyone.
Okay. Wow, it's lighter than I thought.
They're very light. Yeah. Absolutely. Really? They're very ergonomically correct and very, very easy to fire. When my daughter was 13 years old, she could shoot one of these.
Really?
There's no recoil.
Bullets for the AR-15 generally run at about $10 for a box of 20. But if Prop 63 passes this November, gun owners would also have to pay up to $50 for a Department of Justice permit to buy ammunition, and then pay to renew that permit every 4 years. Parkin says this is an unfair burden on honest gun owners like himself.
It would be a huge inconvenience. And it's not going to do anything to keep anyone any safer because you can buy ammo anywhere in the country anyway. People are just going to go out of state. They're going to hoard ammo. They're going to bring it in, whether it's legal or not.
Harkin already has to ID anyone trying to buy a gun and submit that information to California's Department of Justice for a background check. But in an era when guns can be 3D printed at home, gun control supporters say that this doesn't take into account what some consider the deadliest part of the gun, the ammo.
Currently in California, you can have unlimited quantities of this lethal product delivered to your door with no background check, no questions asked.
That's Ari Freilich, staff attorney at San Francisco's Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. He worked closely with Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom's team to draft Prop 63.
I personally, you know, I grew up with guns. I enjoy shooting, and I also believe in responsible gun ownership. I believe gun ownership by responsible people.
The Law Center was founded in the aftermath of a mass shooting in 1993 at a law firm in downtown San Francisco that killed 8 people. The legacy of that incident led California to enact some of the strictest gun control laws in the nation, and President Clinton signed key federal gun control laws in the months after the shooting.
But for all our progress, you know, California still has major loopholes in our laws.
For example, right now, California requires anyone convicted of serious crimes to get rid of their guns. But there's no clear way to do this for the 13,000 people in California's Armed and Prohibited Persons System database. Prop 63 spells out how the state will recover those firearms.
And this law would have teeth. It would require this convicted offender to provide a receipt to the court before final sentencing in their case, showing that they got rid of their illegal guns.
And what about ammo? Well, 7 other gun control laws Governor Brown signed into law earlier this summer cover some similar territory to Prop 63. But the ballot measure goes further. Background checks for ammo purchases will start in the state, whether or not Prop 63 passes. But the ballot measure would ban additional people, like those with concealed weapons permits. Also included in Prop 63 are stiffer penalties for firearm theft, requirements that dealers and individuals report stolen guns or ammo within a few days, and license requirements and background checks for ammunition dealers. Gun rights advocates have portrayed Prop 63's package of laws as a danger to law-abiding citizens. Take this video, put out by the Coalition for Civil Liberties, a project of the California Rifle and Pistol Association, which is the official state chapter of the NRA. A woman walking to her car is attacked by another figure, but she grabs a handgun and shoots. The scene fades out and words appear on the screen reading, "Take away our rights, take away our life." Another group fighting against Prop 63 calls themselves Veto Gunmageddon. This all-volunteer-run organization is launching an anti-Prop 63 campaign at the end of September. Spokesperson Sean Brandon spoke to me via Skype from his house in Bakersfield.
I am a liberal, but I also am a gun owner.
He describes himself as a rare Democrat in conservative Kern County.
I'm not hoarding ammo and living in a bunker with a tin hat. You know, I'm a regular person. I got 2 kids. I'm a family guy. I spend time with my family. You know, I'm just a regular person.
Brandon says he's a history buff, which makes sense because by trade, he deals in collectible guns. He has dozens of firearms from different places and different eras.
And just because you have a lot of guns doesn't mean that, you know, you're like some gun nut waiting for the end of the world. I'm not waiting for the end of the world.
Brandon doesn't think Prop 63 will keep Californians any safer. He thinks it's unfair to law-abiding gun owners like himself. He has 2 sons, aged 9 and 12, both of whom know how to shoot a .22 rifle.
So if you want to take your son out to go target shooting and you go down to your local Walmart, you have to go through a full background check process just to be able to buy a box of .22 shells to go target shooting.
Veto Gunmageddon is gathering petitions to force a referendum on the 7 gun laws passed in the wake of last year's San Bernardino shootings. And the group is also pushing back against what it sees as political jockeying in the California state legislature.
Another mass shooting, another school shooting. More preschoolers getting shot in this country every single year than police officers in the line of duty. We have the ability to do something about it, to protect our families, to protect our communities.
You just heard Gavin Newsom in an ad for Prop 63. Brandon sees the ballot initiative as a strategic ploy by Newsom to launch his gubernatorial campaign. But regardless of why the proposition is on the ballot, the question remains, will laws like these work to reduce gun violence in California's communities? As the debate around gun control rages, it's hard to make sense of the data. The numbers on gun control and firearm deaths are tricky to interpret and can be skewed by factors other than gun laws. Research in 2011 from The Atlantic found lower firearm deaths in states with stricter gun laws, like assault weapon bans. Yet, factcheck.org found in 2012 that firearm murders are down even as gun ownership is up. When it comes to ammunition, some cities have already been taking action. Both San Francisco and Oakland have passed ordinances requiring records of ammunition sales. Starting July 2019, under current state law, California will follow suit. Recent polls show that a majority of voters support Prop 63, with Election Day less than 7 weeks away. Until then, for KALW, I'm Lucy Kang.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. In January 1969, two members of the Black Panther Party, Al Prentiss, Bunchy Carter, and John Huggins, were shot and killed on the campus of UCLA. Larry Watani Steiner and his brother were arrested and convicted for the murders. They were members of US, another Black Power organization active at the time. They were sent to San Quentin State Prison. In 1974, the Steiner brothers escaped. Watani fled to South America, where he lived for 2 decades. Eventually, he turned himself in to the U.S. authorities and was returned to San Quentin in 1994. While there, he began a correspondence with Erica Huggins, a former Black Panther Party leader and the wife of one of the men he was accused of killing. Watani Steiner was released from prison last year. He's starting his life over as a free man in Oakland, not far from where Erica Huggins lives. But the conditions of his parole prohibit any contact between them. KALW's Julie Kane spoke with both of them separately and wove together this story about the healing power of dialogue.
Dear Erica.
Dear Erica.
In my heart, I have written this letter to you and your daughter many times over. Yet now that I am confronted with how it might be received by you, I can't seem to find the right set of words.
I hope what I have to say is received by you
in
the loving and
compassionate way in which it is felt and conveyed. My name is Watani Steiner, and during the tumultuous Black Power era of the 60s, I was a member of Marlana Karinga's US organization. On January 17, 1969,
I was present on the UCLA campus when a shooting erupted between members of US
and the Black Panther Party. In the aftermath of that tragic encounter, John, your husband, and Bunchy Carter were both shot and killed.
I'm currently incarcerated at San Quentin State Prison on a conspiracy charge related to their deaths.
Although I did not pull the trigger of the gun that took the lives of John and Bunchy, I have carried a heavy burden of guilt, knowing that I had contributed to the atmosphere resulting in the deaths of two human beings. Erica, she had a 3-week-old daughter at the time that her husband was killed. And, you know, so she had to, you know, had to raise that child. She had to answer all the questions that the child had about, you know, what was daddy like, who was daddy. I had thoughts in my head about how she was making it, you know, as I was going through my own separation from my own children. My journey of love and sacrifice for my own children has opened up my heart and allowed me to feel the emptiness you must have felt on that dreadful day you learned of John's death.
The confusion, the questions, the pain,
and the realization that your daughter would never get to know her father. For that, I am truly sorry. No words could ever fill the space left
in a father's absence.
Moreover, it is my contention that the UCLA shooting remains one of the most unresolved conflicts within the Black Power movement.
I knew from everybody I'd spoken to that there was somebody who pulled the trigger, and Watani Steiner was not one of them. That was clear. So I kept wondering, well, who knows the true story? But more important for me, all those years since January 17, 1969, at UCLA in broad daylight, I wondered, who can I talk to? My dear friend, Fania Davis, called me and left a message. And it simply said, "Hey, Erica, I was at San Quentin today giving a presentation on restorative justice, and a man walked up to me and he said, 'Do you think Erica Huggins would enter a restorative justice conversation with me?'"
I didn't know what to expect. I was a little nervous because I figured that she might say, well, you know, I got a lot of nerve trying to contact her, and I was involved with, you know, her husband getting killed.
She asked him his name. He said, Watani Steiner. She called me, and I'm listening to my voicemail, and I'm going, yes, 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 into the phone with no human being on the other end.
So I finally, after tearing up numerous letters, I wrote her a letter, and I told her, how sorry I was that it happened. I didn't apologize for anything specific I did, but I apologized for what I termed this warrior mindset that we had during the 60s.
I wrestled with what had happened at UCLA. And what I should have done differently.
There is no justification for the killings of another human being. I thought about you and your daughter often, wondering how you and she were making it without John. The tragic irony of my situation, still doing time for a 40-year-old conspiracy conviction, seems utterly preposterous. I believe that because there was never any serious dialogue or genuine attempt at conflict resolution between us and the Panthers, history was unable to reveal to us and teach our children anything about truth, reconciliation, and forgiveness. I'm wondering if there is anything that can be done about it now.
I didn't do anything right away because I contacted my daughter, John's daughter, and some of my family members to let them know I would enter into this conversation.
She wrote a letter, and the letter was, it was the most moving letter I've ever received.
Dear Watani.
Dear Watani.
Thank you so much for your heartfelt letter. For many years, I wondered what happened on that day at UCLA. Was John happy, smiling before it all happened?
Was he thinking about his three-week-old daughter?
Was he aware that he would die? I know in my heart that the answer to all of these questions is yes. I wondered what really killed John and Bunchy. Somehow I knew that even the person who fired the shots was not at the root of the actions. History, as it impacts the present, was at play. The history of the United States, the history of John, Bunchy, Erica, Watani, all of us. Everything coalesced to create that singular event and the many events that arose from it.
I don't want to give the impression that it was one nice letter after the other. It was some letters with some deep questions about, what actually happened. What do you really think about this? And I had some issues about certain things that I saw it as another way. So we were able to maintain our being respectful, being kind, but being honest.
We were wrong, And we were right.
We were wrong, and we were right.
Life is full of paradoxes and is never simply either or. My request is that as we talk, we agree to a both and principle. Humans are capable of the most heinous actions and the most lovely.
And the most lovely.
All in one day.
All in one day.
In 1 minute.
We shared a lot of little things about, you know, our lives and our struggle. And through that, we really were ready when we had the face-to-face. You know, because when we sat down, we pretty much knew each other's, you know, whole life story. You know, and, you know, we laughed. You know, we had little jokes and stuff we said in there. We, you know, but the beginning was, you know, she actually wanted to know what happened.
He told me he entered the room and he had to step over John and Bunchy's bodies. So something in my stomach flipped when he said he walked over their bodies, and I only had one question. How did you know they were dead? He said, I could see John and Bunchy, but everything was moving quickly and in slow-mo at the same time. They looked so peaceful, like they were sleeping. And that answered a question of pain. I couldn't ask Watani, do you think they suffered? But I held it in my heart. When he said they looked peaceful, their faces were soft, like they were sleeping, something in me felt such gratitude to know that.
It took work. And looking at it from the restorative justice model and that how important dialogue is in getting to that, I think that kept us from passing blame on somebody or trying to excuse something or justify it or something happened, you know. So that was a great moment for me.
May you and your daughter receive good things without number and many blessings without end.
Watani.
Watani. I appreciate your willingness to be in conversation with me and with yourself. Your self-inquiry touches me at a deep and resonant level. I've spent many years recognizing this freeing and challenging concept, self-forgiveness.
Thank you very much for writing and reflecting on what I write and writing again. May your days and nights be full of peace.
Erica.
Those were the voices of Erica Huggins and Watani Steiner. The piece was produced by KALW's Julie Kane. She spoke with Erica and Watani separately. Based on the terms of his parole, the two haven't had any contact since his release from San Quentin in 2015.
I have serious news to pass on to everybody. What I'm about to say couldn't mean the world's disaster.
This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. For our next story, we are going to return to San Quentin State Prison. Many people here in our news department spend a lot of time working with inmates there, helping them learn how to tell their own stories. It's a project called the San Quentin Prison Report.
The San Quentin Prison Report.
Bringing you hidden stories from life inside.
In order to make something grow, you got to own a little dirt.
You don't tell, you see what goes on.
Because I like to be free. I like to move about the land.
You can hear a pin drop.
The men you just heard have a recording studio in one of the common buildings off the prison yard. They aren't allowed to take their microphones out without special permission. So when reporter Martina Castro visited them at San Quentin, she asked them to imitate the sounds of daily life there. Let's have a listen to how they sound all together.
Strip down.
Ching, 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 ching.
Second tier, chow time.
5 minutes to lock up.
Ding. 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 Ding.
So what do those sounds signify? Here's Martina with the answers.
Okay, so we're just going to talk about sounds of San Quentin.
This is the one recording I was able to make that day. I used a microphone the SQPR reporters had connected to one of their computers in their makeshift production studio. You know, for a lot of people, describing the sounds of where they live is hard. But these guys, they jumped right in.
Gar keys.
Ching, 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 ching.
San Quentin's alarm.
They count everybody inside of the prison. It's counted at about 3:30, 4 o'clock.
Ding, ding, ding.
13 to start, 3 to stop, every day.
5 minutes to lock up.
And when does that happen?
About 9 o'clock.
5 minutes for child. Yeah, 5 down and 1 up, like for the tiers, because it's one of the 5 tiers. So they say start from the 5th tier down or from the 1st tier up.
So you're listening for your tier number.
This is for your tier number. So they say 2nd tier, chow time.
What else? What are some other sounds?
The showers.
You walk in the tiers. Cookies on the tier. Cookies.
Get
all on the line.
The
dude selling little bottles of oil for $1. The dude has a little rhythm. He says, $1 oil on the line. $1 oil on the line.
You can hear in the game, be like, 15. Fool out domino, fool domino with 25.
Down on the yard. So that means that a fight has occurred or something medical has occurred, so we have to get down.
These sounds are a big part of the regimented and repetitive life in there. Even the dreaded clanging of the old pipes, which often interrupt their recordings.
Clack, 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 clack.
And then it was time to wrap things up. But one of the guys, Greg Eskridge, he had a question for me.
So when you go home right now, go out there to the world, one of your friends say, so how was it going to a prison?
Oh, I'm going to tell him it's just like, almost like regular life.
Almost. You know, part of me is embarrassed to hear myself say that. Clearly, prison life isn't normal. But there was something really comfortable and normal about how I felt right then. In this room full of men convicted of serious crimes, I never in a million years thought that possible. But there we were, and it felt almost like everyday life. The last sound I remember from my visit was the voice of one of the inmate reporters who said to me as we were exchanging goodbyes, "Don't let people out there forget about us. Tell them we are here paying for our crimes, and we are still redeemable. Tell them we can be rehabilitated and return to the world better people."
That was Martina Castro at San Quentin State Prison speaking with members of SQPR, the San Quentin Prison Report. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. All right, we've heard the sounds of San Quentin State Prison. Now let's hear a story from KALW's partnership project with the San Quentin Prison Report. Tommy Shakur Ross produced this piece about the unexpected bonds that can appear between inmates.
In spite of the divisions along ethnic and religious lines, the community here at San Quentin is relatively interconnected. So it isn't uncommon for prisoners to befriend one another who share different religious beliefs.
My name is Isaiah Thompson Bonilla. Most of the brothers know me as Abdul Rahim. I am Muslim.
My name is Derek Holloway. I'm a minister, ordained pastor. I function in the ministry here.
Rahim and Holloway are two prisoners at San Quentin, a Muslim and Christian. Rahim explains that at first they were acquaintances. They were introduced through a mutual friend about 4 years ago.
We would always acknowledge one another when we seen each other, always in passing, but maybe a minute or two conversation here or there. a laugh and a joke, and then we'd be on our way.
Then something happens that challenges their association. Raheem says one evening in his cell, while looking through his things, he rediscovers these old newspaper articles from 20 years ago. While reviewing the articles that night, he notices something about the name of the person who killed his uncle.
And when I read the first name, that it dawned on me that the Holloway that I had befriended was potentially the very person who murdered my great uncle.
Raheem's no stranger to violence. He says he's in prison for 2 counts of attempted murder and 5 counts of armed robbery, and that he's also a former special ops combat veteran. So when Raheem realizes that Holloway is in prison for murdering his uncle, he says that he immediately went into conflict with himself.
I began to teeter on that old thinking that if you harm anything of mine, then I must harm something of yours. If I can't get to you, I'll get someone that is close to you. That will even the score.
The very next day, Raheem calls a family friend. Although he doesn't go into detail, he tells his friend that he's faced with the most challenging experience since being in prison. The friend then contacts Raheem's mother. And when Raheem calls his mother later that day, he says she somehow knew exactly the challenge he was facing.
That was that mother's intuition. I haven't talked with my mother about the murder of my uncle in probably 20 years, but she knew right away. The first words out of her mouth was, "You ran into that boy who killed your uncle, didn't you? And no matter what you do, you can't undo what happened 20 years ago. I know what you're thinking." She said, "Derek is not the same man he was 20 years ago, and neither are you."
And Raheem is in agreement. He's not the man he was 20 years ago.
I sat in that for a moment. It didn't undo the feeling I had inside me, but it made me come to reason with what actions I needed to pursue going forward.
After talking to his mother, Raheem says when he first saw Holloway, he intentionally kept himself from confronting him. But he saw him again later in the day.
The case that you're convicted on and the reason why you're in prison today, the victim in that case was my uncle, Brian Thompson.
I begin to feel this overwhelming sorrow and being face to face with the crime that I committed.
And he just dropped his head and I just let him sit there for a moment. At this time, I'm not sure where I'm going with this, but it was just something on my heart that I had to get off, because just sitting on it and not saying nothing was eating away at me in a negative way.
And he was a man that I respected, that I have grown to like, and I had committed this atrocity against his family. And there was nothing that I could do to make it better.
He looked up, his eyes full of tears, and he just told me how sorry he was. And I could see it, I could feel it. And I was emotional. And I told him, I said, I don't really know where this is coming from, brother, but I sit before you today, and I can honestly say that I forgive you.
To witness reconciliation and forgiveness in action in real time.
That's Protestant chaplain Marty Ralph Jackson.
It filled my heart to overflowing, because that's really the Bible in action. As Raheem began to talk to Derek, Derek was humbled and broken. And Raheem, he extended grace and mercy in a way that you don't always see with two men.
As for the Muslim Christian aspect,
I'm happy that he's a Christian. I'm overjoyed because it has allowed him to be the person you see sitting before you today. Had he not done that, my feelings towards him may be different.
He is such a leader, so I know that Islam has played a huge part in that. And so it gives him a vehicle to be able to express what God has done through him and in him.
But most of all, Raheem says Holloway's helped him avenge his uncle's death.
He has helped me to murder the person who has murdered my uncle, because he no longer lives. Mm-hmm. This man is a different individual. And I want everybody in this room and whoever hears this broadcast to know that.
Thank you. Because he's truly dead. I thank God that he has given me the gift of forgiveness. You know, and it's a gift. And I will not squander it.
So there you have it. A nephew's forgiveness. I'm Tommy Shakur Ross with the San Quentin Prison Report.
Thanks to our colleagues at San Quentin State Prison who produced SQBR. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.